Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. Every month, as you know, Woody Curry, who is clinical and director and associate executive director of the Baltimore Station, joins us. And we talk about all manner of things when it comes to addiction in our society and what goes on and why it's such a mad world and what we can do about it, what our responsibility and all that is. He joins us once again. Always good to have him in the studio.
Thanks, Mark.
It's good to see Woody. And once again, we are joined by Dr. Grady Dale, who is a clinical psychologist, executive director of Urban Psychological Services, one of the few clinical psychologists in our community that devotes his work to children, especially children in our inner cities. And Grady, always good to see you. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it.
Number here is 410-319-8888. 410-319-8888. One of the things we were talking about, Woody, when we were on the phone, just think about what we were talking about today. And we know it's close to Memorial Day. We could do all kinds of veteran shows, which we have those booked and taped for Monday. We started talking about post-traumatic stress and how it goes beyond just people who come through war, but can affect people for all kinds of reasons, from all kinds of places. And that when you look at the question of what poverty does, the violence of poverty, the urban violence that goes around young people, that the psychic conflicts, what it does to the central nervous systems, what distorted images of self and all that come to bear for these kids when they see what they see. Some of the studies I've been reading the last couple of days, and aren't that many, by the way, we'll talk about that, is that, you know, 95% of the kids in any given community have already seen someone murdered by the time they're 5 years old, or someone physically assaulted in a severe way by the time they're 5 years old, and things inside the home and out. So you've been working with post-traumatic stress for years with people. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, one thing I was thinking after you and I had the conversation, I had been looking at it for quite some time, and I look at people, you know, who go through the violence and the social upheavals and the personal upheavals of drug addiction, the disassociation, the loss of family, the loss of self-esteem, the loss of jobs, the loss of identity. I mean, that's a traumatic experience. And then they stop the drug, and you expect them just to bounce back. But when I looked at kids, I'm looking at the people in our population who are the most vulnerable. They have literally no defense against the stuff, you know, when it happens at an early age. And it's a life changer. It's a game changer. But people don't look at that. I don't think they look at that. They blame the kids, but the kids are the most vulnerable of the population. And, I mean, you know, being a veteran and then dealing with veterans and being hospitalized myself with PTSD and things, and I know how hard it is to cope with it as a grown-up. I mean, very few people get to the place where they can actually live with this stuff and manage it. You know, it takes a lot of focus. It takes a lot of work. It's a monumental task, okay, to live with something like that and be so self-aware that you know that your reactions are overreactions, that you know your hypervigilance is part of your experience, that you know that your nocturnal awakening and walking the streets at night and things like that, and the flashbacks and the dreams and the mood swings and the things, just rage that just shows up out of the blue at the slightest little thing. You can see all of that in yourself, and then you learn to manage it over the years. But kids, I think, become somewhat desensitized to it because they really don't have a reference point to try to even incorporate or process this stuff. It's just a view of a world that's totally threatening and unpredictable.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Great.
Oh, I totally agree with that. and I would add, just to step back a little bit, you know, talk about children's development and developing brains. As folks may know, we have developed brains. In fact, if just for purposes of information, the brain actually doesn't fully stop growing until about age 25 in terms of its mass. Think about a child's brain from the inception on. There are all kinds of connections that are being made in the brain, and the brain is still growing. And children are absorbing a whole lot, both bad and good. And so their brains are absorbing. So whatever comes at them from the outside, that's what they absorb. Not only do they absorb, their brains are absorbing all kinds of social stuff and what we say and what we do, their personalities are being formed. And their personalities are being formed in such a way that that becomes the basis of how they respond to the world in general. Well, superimpose that on children who are at the least in very difficult situations, and at the most in very violent situations. Just think about a brain that's developing and what that brain is incorporating when they see and hear and feel violence or feel upset, or even parents who argue a lot. Just think about what that does. That puts a picture in a child's brain as they develop, what was said before, that there's disorganization. There's disorganization in the household. And a child, more than anything, needs organization. He needs some sense of belonging and needs some sense of stability. When you're seeing disorder around you, and so you're trying to figure out what all of that is, and your brain is trying to incorporate that, and you're trying to figure out how to cope, that becomes very, very difficult for the development brain. And because of that, children can suffer in these situations.
Folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. A lot of teachers call all the time talking about kids with outrageous, unruly behavior in classrooms. Or you can join us with your thoughts and ideas, or parents and young people yourselves, when we talk about what young people see. So the question is, why, when we talk about, as I was reading these articles, I was thinking about growing up. And I was thinking about growing up, at least for the first, besides, the all inter-family stuff that we all have to deal with that goes on inside families and the kind of psychological things that happen to kids that were there at home. But that when you grow up in a relatively stable, working-class, middle-class world where there's no violence outside, we don't see people being shot. You don't see people hanging on the corner selling drugs. There's not a lot of sexual violence in the community. You don't see it. And you live a relatively stable life. So, and then, that's how, but then we have these our children who come from a lot of poor neighborhoods in our public school system. And why do we never make the correlation between acting out and what they see? Acting out and what they've experienced. Acting out and living in a home where there is dysfunction and no father, or the stuff goes on that's abusive. We don't think about that in terms of why kids aren't learning. So we always say all kids can achieve. Well, yes, all kids can achieve. But why don't we ever take these things into account when we think about how we address our children and deal with our schools?
When you're living in a survival mode, when survival is your basic mode of reference, okay, everything else becomes almost secondary. Okay, food. Bottom line, every human being desires is safety and security. Okay, when you're in an environment that's not predictable, that's all of this upheaval, when there's nothing going on that makes any sense to a kid, when parents don't have time to sit with the kids and give them the sense of love and safety and security, the parents are scrimping and scraving or living in a drug-infested neighborhood and maybe involved in a drug trade, that becomes the kid's world. That environment and the kids living in that environment becomes the basis for how that kid sees the world almost the rest of his life, you see. And that's the basis of their understanding. There's nothing safe. There's nothing consistent. There's nothing reliable. There's nobody to trust. Anything can happen. I don't know where the next meal's coming from. I got to go out and get this. I got to go out and get that. What sense does learning about history and mathematics and English and all of those irrelevant things mean to someone who's constantly in a survival mode, expecting the unexpected?
Mm-hmm. And yes, I agree with that. And when they get to school, it's very interesting about schools. Schools want order, and they want kids to be in order. But they do bring all of those behaviors from home. And, if you look in the environment that we're in, talk about the city, but you also talk about other jurisdictions as well. School personnel really don't have a whole lot of time to be making connections. You say they don't want to, they don't care to, because they're busy doing some other things. They're just trying to hold things together. It's not that the adults don't see it, but they don't want to particularly handle it because it's too much trouble. Now, in spite of the fact that there are, as you know, there are mental health clinics in a number of the schools here in the city, what have you, but basically those clinics and those kinds of situations are basically overwhelmed. There are more kids who come to school with behavioral problems than they can handle with all of the concurrent family problems and all those kinds of things. When a kid's in the classroom, the teacher just, if you got 30, 35 kids in the classroom, they don't have time to be dealing with this kid with outbursts. They just send them out of the class and send them someplace else where somebody can deal with them. It's really a shame that has to happen. I'm staying away from the whole business about people don't care. I'm very careful about, I think people do care, but in situations like schools, they just want things, the school personnel just want things to be right, and the kid is not fitting into that environment because they're acting out, then they got to go someplace else. They get suspended, they get dismissed or something like that, and they don't deal with the problem. And unfortunately, that's the way that a lot of these things are dealt with.
Folks, 410-319-8888, we want to see how you would, how should we address this, and how, and what is, in your experience, have you seen and worked as a parent, as a community member, as a teacher? We hear about people always complaining about the lack of parenting, people knowing how to raise their children. You hear that all the time on this program. People can call in to talk about that when it comes to kids in our communities and kids in our public schools. That itself is a piece of this. But many times we're talking probably about hundreds of kids, thousands of children in the city, thousands of children in the city who are children of children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
I mean, so the question is, you're putting your hands around those issues.
Yeah.
I mean, it's there's a larger economic question I want to raise later about poverty and work that can transform things, obviously. There's more than any therapy can in the long run, but. And these are a lot of the kids you see.
Yeah, a lot of kids I see. And, boy, I can tell you that the parents, their extended families, and all of them need so much support, more than I can give as an individual, more than the collective thing is important. I find that one of the things that I find doing a lot is trying to connect families and trying to connect kids with other kinds of services in the community that can help them through some of the dire stuff that they have to go through. And that connecting is something that takes a lot of work and it takes a lot of time. But without that, kids just languish in a number of these communities. And even though we have some services in the community, I think it's no surprise that folks would be in one particular neighborhood in Baltimore in some row house somewhere and just as isolated as they can be. If they go to school, if they're halfway quiet, they're halfway getting good grades, no one much pays attention to them until, of course, they act out. And then they go back home and they live basically a life of obscurity until something happens and then everything blows to smithereens. So this whole connectivity with community resources and with our communities is real, real important stuff. And I've said this before, unless the community aspects and parenting aspects and all of us kind of want to work together and we can find people who want to work together with these problems, it doesn't solve itself. But that connectivity is extremely important.
410-319-8888. I mean, I really want to talk to you all about how you would put your hands around this, how, as a society, what has to be done how do you treat children like this? You were talking about how it's hard enough treating adults, men who come back from war, women who have been been raped and sexually abused to go through post-traumatic stress, it's hard enough for adults to put their hands around the trauma they've experienced, let alone children that we're also trying to educate.
I don't think they see it. They don't see it. They see post-traumatic stress in certain instances. and mainly it's in adults. They don't see it in kids because they, you know, we live in this phenomenological world that ideas are real. You know, where what we think and the things we say are the reality of life. Those are descriptions of something. But the reality is this stuff is very traumatic. I mean, coming up in a neighborhood where there's violence anytime, okay, where there's drug dealing, where there's fights, where there's alcoholism, drug addiction, both parents addicted, split homes, mothers don't like fathers, fathers don't like mothers, single parent families. What does a kid have for a reference point? What does a kid have for a role model? What happened to them? The role models now are athletes, entertainers. Who else? Mm-hmm. I mean, honestly, who else? Mm-hmm. Who else do kids have to look up to? Who's espousing any values or anything like that? Politicians, and the ones who's espousing the values are living, talking clean and living dirty. Mm-hmm. What does a kid have for a role model? What kind of world? Kids aren't stupid. Kids are, I think, more in tune with what's going on than most adults because kids don't haven't learned how to process stuff and turn around, tell a lie about it and rearrange it and politicize it and all of that. So they call it like it is, you see. And most of the time, a kid is seeing the truth because that's all he's equipped to do. The truth is what's really going on, not how you phrase it, not how you spin it, not how you politicize it. It's what it really is. And that's what the kid's working with. And the adult is trying to tell him, well, that's not how it is. Kids, well, you mean that's not how it is? That's what it is. No, you're not supposed.
And yes, and, you know, children, especially young children, see the truth. But, you know, they don't know how to really process the truth in the sense of, you know, they will incorporate that, but what they can do about that, that's another thing. That's another thing. And, you know, kids get real, especially young children, kids get real agitated when they see the truth, but they don't really know what to do with it because their brains are not processed enough to know exactly what to do with that. And so, you know, you see kids are agitated or kind of reenacting things. And when you see, when you talk about kids in school that are agitated and things like that, well, so what? A lot of kids are agitated, you know? So why should a teacher with a classroom full of 30 kids stop because a kid is agitated? And that goes back to not recognizing PTSD symptoms when you see it, because most, even parents don't really see it. Mm-hmm. They just see this kid that's just kind of sort of acting out, you know? And parents, teaching and working with parents to help them, not only they understand what the PTSD symptoms are, but get this, just understanding what child development is. You'd be surprised for the parents that I understand. They don't know. They raise kids, but they don't know what child development is. They don't know what happens between 5 and 8 and between 12 and 16. You know, it's a mystery until something happens with the kid, and then the kid acts out, and they scratch their heads and say, what's going on? This kid's bad. So helping parents absorb what parenting is, let alone what PTSD symptoms are, is a real challenge. And that's where teachable moments can be provided.
Let's open the phones here. A lot of people are calling in to join this conversation. We're talking about what we don't recognize. And we're talking especially about kids who come from the poorest working class communities in our country, where violence is rampant, where broken homes are rampant, where our penal system has become the new slavery where people are put by the droves in prisons and come out, and prison culture kind of takes over the street. What happens to the kids? 410-319-8888 is the number here. We're joined by Woody Curry and Dr. Grady Dale, and we see who's been holding on the longest. We start with Linda. Linda in Baltimore, you're on the air. Linda, you're on the air. Linda? Okay, Linda, let's leave Linda hold on a second. Don't hang up on her. We'll go to the next caller and come back to Linda to see if she comes back. Keith, you're on the air.
I just had one question for Mr. Curry and them. Like, I hear about the people, the kids that don't really make it out of these crime-infested neighborhoods, but I've lived in Baltimore just about all my life, and thank God I had two, you know, good grandparents that wanted to make sure that we got out and everything. But you know, everybody's not a statistic. It's not like, you know, I mean, I was raised up in violence. I was raised up on Park Heights Avenue and down in North and Pulaski, two of the most violent neighborhoods in the city of Baltimore. But you just got to make, I think, in each case, a person got to sit back and make a choice for themselves. If your mom and pop is doing bad, don't mean that you're going to follow in the same route. Now, if you just see them getting high or going back and forth to prison and everything like that, I mean, you got to make a conscious choice for yourself. No, I mean, do I want that life? I mean, do I want to follow in their footsteps? So, I mean, I really wish there was like a really a solid answer that, you know,
Keith, your cell phone's breaking up. But, okay. Baby, go ahead.
Yeah, if you know, the personality is formed somewhere between 5 and 7 years old. And Keith is talking about choices and options. What choices and options does a 5 and 7 year old kid has? He's talking about something further mm-hmm. down the road when he can make choices and process information and differentiate. We're talking about kids, not teenagers. Okay, and there's exceptions to the rule, and we're talking about kids that are traumatized, not the whole population. Okay, you can't split hairs and use one example when this problem is a lot bigger. That sounds more like a political statement. Somebody who's made it out of the ghetto and I'm okay now, so what's wrong with everybody else? That's nice if you want to make a political statement and say, you know, to minimize what we're talking about. We're not talking about that. Mm-hmm. It's obvious that happens, but more or less we're talking about a very real problem.
Yeah, it's highly possible that Keith might have, even within the framework of his neighborhood, might have had some stability. I think he mentioned his grandparents, and his grandparents mm-hmm. may have been that stability. The other thing that we know is that Keith has a point in the sense that, you know, not everyone who lives in violent neighborhoods turns violent or has
right.
But if you ask me the question whether the chances of you living in that atmosphere, whether you will have some, pardon the expression, symptoms of that kind of thing, the chances are high. Even though some kids have something that we've been always trying to understand, why some kids have more resiliency than others. Some kids have more resiliency by virtue of their personality, by virtue of their style. But again, you can have a stable existence of some sort within the framework of a violent neighborhood, and that can have just as much of a positive impact on you as others. If that's the case, then it's possible you can be in a neighborhood and people kind of shelter you along and help you to move through that, and you survive, which is wonderful.
Let's try Linda again, see if she's there. Linda, you're on the air. Linda, are you there? Okay. Linda's not there. Let's go on to the next call. Next caller is Chris in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Hello. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi, Chris.
I missed the very beginning, so if I'm a little off your topic, I apologize. But Mark, first I want to thank you for allowing these topics that you have on the show, because you touch on a lot of things that are important. I actually called yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to tie the conversation from yesterday into this one today. I used to work in group homes with boys that came from social service in our community. When you take all of the factors that your guest mentioned, the different issues of the parents and him.
Chris, you still there? Is the cell phone go down? Chris, call back. We'll come back on and get you back on. Let's go to the next caller, and we'll come back to Chris. Mike, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, folks. This is not a cell phone, so I hope I'll be able to complete my comment, and I'm looking forward to your...
And if not, then it's a mass conspiracy to stop you from talking.
No doubt. I suspected that. No, quite seriously, because this is a serious matter. First of all, every thinking, caring human being supports the efforts of the guests here to try and understand these problems and treat the individuals as best they can.
Right.
That being said, I would like to offer what I frankly consider a necessary condition to solve the damn problems. when you're living in a environment that's characterized by violence and fear and what the guests are describing, folks, what you see is what you get. It will not improve unless we abolish poverty. That sounds unrealistic, a political statement, if you will. So be it. If we don't deal with the cause, we better get used to the effect.
Well, I Mike has a point in terms of that the issues we're seeing. I mean, the mass dislocation of families in the poorest neighborhoods in America is a political question. It is a function of the economy. It is a function of the loss of jobs and the mass incarceration of African-American men and families falling apart and not building housing stock that makes that people can live in decent homes and not having schools, even though some communities like this one are attempting to change that at least on the school front. I mean, but that is real. I mean, there is a political economic basis to what we're facing here.
Of course, and it's based on the type of governments in the system we live in. When you start talking about poverty and when you start talking about this stuff, there are people who hear redistribution of wealth, socialism, things like that.
Dangerous words.
I know. See, so don't go down that road and expect to have a clear path, you see, because that just is not going to happen. Not in this lifetime and not in a whole lot more to come around. This whole system is based on entrepreneurship, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, make some money, be a success, and things like that. And these things that we are talking about, we had this discussion before, Mark. They look at that as collateral damage.
Right, and that is the political part of it.
I know.
The political part is the organization of people who are the collateral damage and those who would ally themselves with the collateral damage is to say no more collateral damage.
Yeah.
We tried that.
Yeah.
We haven't stopped yet, though.
I know. Yeah.
And that's why trying to deal with this, as simplistic as this is, trying to deal with this one family at a time is something that I have to deal with on a daily basis. And that family, of course, who's caught up in these political and social economic travesties and experiencing that firsthand, you know, we see them all the time. And so we have to make a decision how and under what circumstances we help those individual families. That doesn't solve the major political problem, but it's certainly for. I sometimes think if more people would take the chance and take the risk, and do some work and some, I dare say, volunteering and all of those kinds of things with families, you can make a difference, even though the bigger picture is not liable to get as good as we think it is.
We have to take a very brief break and come right back. When we come back, Linda was Brenda. So we'll come back to Brenda and Chris, who called back as well. Bud is also on the line, and another caller is calling in. We'll get to all of your calls when we return. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner here with Dr. Grady Dale, clinical psychologist, executive director of Urban Psychological Services, Woody Curry, clinical director and associate executive director of the Baltimore Station. As we look at post-traumatic stress, what is affecting the children in our poorest neighborhoods, why we don't pay attention to it, what it is, and how do we deal with it. 410-319-8888 is the number here. As I said, we're going to go first to Brenda and then to Chris, who were both that didn't get on the last time. Then we go to our next caller, but I don't see the name of Clifford, I think. So let's go to Brenda. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, Mr. Steiner.
Good afternoon.
This is a really good subject. I'm so happy and relieved that this is on. I want to briefly tell you the story of my grandson, who's now 12, but who was diagnosed at 11 years old with ADHD. My 14-year-old daughter, whom I had like almost 20 years after two other children, got pregnant at 14. This was a gifted, bright, intelligent girl. I was a single woman, but I had been married to her father. I told my daughter, don't worry, you keep going to school and being a teenager, and we'll take care of the baby. All went good until she got 17 years old, graduated school. Her little friends told her how the system, and I'm talking about the public aid system, and I'm talking about in Chicago, would let her become an emancipated teenager, get her own apartment, and they would maintain blah, blah, blah. At that, my daughter took the three-year-old child and went to live with some abandoned, with some other teenagers in an abandoned building. I was told by the police, if I go and got that boy out of that disgusting, disgraceful place, and there was other children there, that I would go to jail. Now, bear in mind, this is my flesh and blood. This is my 17 minor age child that the system has now told they would take her straight from underneath me, but I guess I'm still responsible for her and taking her away from me, the system that is supposed to help you. And, okay, 3 years old, my son told me he was 3 years. He brought him back just before he made four, when he made four in July. He told me all kinds of stuff that he wasn't really mistreated, but he was beaten by her boyfriend's girlfriend, which was going on over there too, and mooned by people. And he told me and my neighbor one time, well, Grandma, I ate Sam's pee-pee. He was 4 years old. 5 years old, my daughter and I had moved, and she was pregnant with another child at 19 now. We got in an argument. She left and took the child and went to stay with the newborn baby's father, okay? She consequently took him to his uncle, who was a homosexual, who was in his mid-30s, left him there from November to March. My grandson started biting his nails. He started stuttering. I saw him on the school bus. He looked like the children of Biafra. Eyes sunken, skinny, pale, stuttering, horrible. He told me all kinds of stuff,
so,
including the sadist treatment he got at the hands of his homosexual uncle.
So, Brenda, let me ask you, so what happened? First of all, let me ask you to turn your radio down because there's a lot of feedback.
The radio's way down. Plus, I'm on the other side of the room.
Okay. So.
Okay, I called CPS. She was on AGCF. I called them. I called the police. I called not most people. The bottom line, the Department of Welfare, they would come out and investigate. And this is when I happened to get the child on the weekends because she was keeping him away from me. The child told me that the last thing he told me, just disgusting, was that his uncle ate cake and ice cream out of his behind.
Okay, I hear you. I know it's really bad, but let me ask our guest to kind of comment on what. How do you intervene in situations like this? What happens to children like this?
Well, it's one of those situations where you have essentially a child with another child. And I guess she was emancipated because of she had a child. And so the mother couldn't do much about that. You know, a 17-year-old is a 17-year-old. I remember when I was 17 years old, you know, there's not much maturity there, no matter how you cut it. The problem is, of course, that her younger child is being traumatized. And hopefully before that child becomes, well, that child is already being victimized, that mother will come to a point where it will seem like she will rely on her background knowledge in terms of what she grew up with, because it sounds like this lady has tried to raise her as best as she could. So the hope is that before she gets to jail, before that child gets sent to social services, that she would at least develop a certain level of maturity so she won't have that 3-year-old traumatized. But it also sounds like that 17-year-old is becoming traumatized herself. And that's very, very difficult. The mom can stay in contact with that daughter as much as their daughter will allow her to. And, you know, intervening is a tough thing to do. Offer the support that you can for her daughter without going through enabling, you know, without trying to make matters worse. And that's important, and pray a lot.
I mean, and very quick, because we have all the calls we have to go to, Brenda, is this in Baltimore or Chicago this is happening? Is Brenda gone? Okay, I'm sorry. So I was going to say if it's Baltimore, find somebody to help intervene.
I mean, they're the usual. I mean, you know, if the child is being abused, obviously, you know, that's the Department of Social Services or a police matter. And actually, you know, crashes the sound, if that mother of this 70-year-old feels like that child is being abused, the Department of Social Services would be called immediately to see what's going on with that child in her neighborhood.
And that's maybe the first line of defense. Brenda, 410-319-8888. Get in touch with us. If it's in Baltimore, we can be of any help to
I want to comment about the system that we live in. That
okay, Brenda, we have a lot of callers, so I have to can't let you go on forever and ever. But make a quick comment. I'm sorry, Brenda. All right, let's go to Clifford. You're on the air. Clifford, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. How are you?
I'm well. Welcome.
Okay. I just want to make three comments. I'll make them as brief as I can, and I'll say that they come from what one might say is a relatively detached place or perhaps an uninformed or unscientific attitude, but there were three things that I heard during the conversation after I tuned in. One was on choices, the other one was on role models, and the third one was, I guess, on some ideas of what to do. The first thing on choices is I've heard too many people talk about how we all have choices and either choose to do right or do wrong. And I think most of the people who make those kinds of statements, quite frankly, are living in a dream world. They don't realize there are a lot of people out here that either due to the circumstance they have to deal with as children or since children or other things, other abuses that are heaped upon them by family or by the system, like the sister who was just talking, they are put in a position where they have to choose between a bad choice and a worse choice. And then we're very judgmental when we come down on them for making a bad choice, not realizing it's probably a cascade effect of a whole lot of choices they were coerced into making with little information and no time to really think things through, and then they wind up in a world of hurt. So that's the one thing I just want to say about as far as choices. We are given A and B to choose from and forget that there are 24 other letters in the alphabet. The thing about role models, it seems that a lot of the role models, it's not that there aren't role models out there, it's that we are given the wrong ones. And sometimes we're even given role models that we don't want. We're given a lot of the people who are in the underworld. We're given a lot of the flash in the pan where the athletes are entertainers. We don't get the political activists. The ones like back in the day, Malcolm was frowned upon. Nowadays, the Panthers are frowned upon. There are political prisoners who've taken a really strong principled stance. They're in prison on trumped-up charges. Those people are constantly denigrated by the popular culture, by law enforcement, by everyone else. There are a lot of role models that a lot of the young people today try to look up to, could look up to, and gain inspiration from. Those people are rejected by the greater system, and as a result, they really can't draw from them. As far as ideas or solutions, maybe what needs to happen is a special cadre of individuals has to be developed that would work in the school system. Maybe the school system won't allow them to do it. Maybe we need to go to independent schools like charter schools, but that these could be people who would specifically work with people who are struggling dealing with those kind of issues and first develop the talent and the skill and the dedication to listen to where they're coming from and help them work out some of those solutions before they try to cram their heads with a lot of historical context that they don't understand that isn't relevant to their immediate lives, but quite frankly, colors the attitude, that colors the environment that they have to go off and they have to deal with every day. Maybe then they can develop an appreciation for that larger historical context, a sociological context,
right,
that the solutions can actually come from, but they don't see it because they're too busy trying to survive day to day.
I think you misunderstood what I said. I was saying that the personality develops. I'll tell you exactly what I said. Personality starts to develop and develops around between 5 and 7 years old. At that time, kids really don't have choices, okay? They don't have choices. They don't even have options. So he misunderstood that completely. I was referring to when a person gets older and is in a position where he can look at things and process things and make choices then, not as children, and that's what we're talking about. Kids really don't have choices in those kind of situations. So this dream world reference is about as far away as the man in the moon, really, because I deal with stuff on a daily basis, right up in it every day, all day. Right. And the other thing about role models is my parents were my role models, my hardworking father. I'm not talking about Hollywood and stuff like that. They were really responsible people that interacted with the community on a daily basis in the community. There were ministers in the community. There were lawyers in the community. There were doctors in the community that used to make house visits and stuff like that and sit down and talk to kids and tell them about things, about education and stuff like that. I came up at a time, Mark, when their poverty wasn't – it was there, but it wasn't as blatant and felt. Because if everybody is – you know, this poverty level stuff is some more political stuff. Back then – everybody worked. Everybody took care of the kids. The kids went to school. The kids went to Sunday school. The kids went to church. The kids did what they were told. The kids ran errands. I had a paper route. I shined shoes. I ran errands. I did things and stuff like that to make my own little money and stuff like that. You know what I'm saying? That's lacking nowadays. I'm not talking about Michael Jordan and multimillionaires and rap stars. That's what kids look at now. I'm talking about the role models within the community, within the home, that can teach these kids these values and stuff. Where are they?
Yeah, I would add, and I would add to what was very nicely said before about kids' development. by the time they get to 5 years old, you're absolutely right. Their personalities are developing, and I will also say that we have a we now know that actually kids begin to form their personality styles even younger than that. Going back 2 or 3 years old, and that role modeling is crucial for kids because right from the get go, as they say, they're automatically taking on some of the nuances of their parents. The other thing I just wanted to mention, just to kind of put this in perspective, because I've actually written some things on kids in foster care and post-traumatic stress. I don't want us to get the impression that all children, if we try to portray, all children are in inner city neighborhoods are experiencing PTSD. That's not the case. I'm heartened by how resilient kids are. I think I've said this before. I'm amazed that, believe it or not, most children in the city public school system, this may be hard for some people to believe, most people in the city public school system go to school, do what they need to do, and go home. That might be very striking for folks. The majority of kids are not raising hell. You get, by the time you get through the media and by the time you get through these subjects, you think that everything is going to pot. It isn't. We have a cadre of kids that are really, really at risk. But the good news is that most are by hook or crook are being raised by their mothers or by their grandparents. They're trying to keep track of these kids. And most of them are coming home. They get into mischievous stuff and they do stuff and they shouldn't do, but they get through it. Now, it's up to the role models to make sure that they stay through it because there are lots of influences in those neighborhoods that can set them on a wrong path. But thank goodness, if all of our children were experiencing this kind of agitation, we would be in real, real trouble. And fortunately, you know, the good news is that, you know, it's not the majority of kids who are experiencing this.
And let me just say, we'll go to the next caller here, that Brenda who called earlier. If you want some intervention, just write us here at steinershow@gmail.com. I'll be glad to be back in touch with you. If it's Baltimore or Chicago, we have contacts in Chicago, to put the right people on it to rescue your grandson. But please give us a call, and I will help put some of those wheels into motion. I can't promise anything, but clearly we'll help you put those wheels into motion. 410-319-8888. Lay in Baltimore County, it's on line 3. Lay or Lee?
Hi.
Hi, Lee.
Okay. I called in because I was listening in, and I'm actually a mother of a child who is diagnosed with PTSD, which from everything I've been through in the last 4 years with her, I'm kind of understanding that a lot of people really don't understand it with children, and it was very hard to find any kind of treatment.
Mm-hmm.
They did kind of say that, and the reason her medical team has said that is because there is a known... She's had known trauma, so they're able to point it to to certain trauma, so they know that's there and they're acknowledging it. But there's times I've been through this and I go, wow, if nobody had listened, nobody paid attention, or if I wasn't, you know, aware and noticing that something was going on with my child, I can easily see that I would have just thought her behavior was, you know, an unruly kid or something.
Right. No, right, right. I mean, it's like you said that she had you, and you saw the symptoms, you saw that she was in trouble, and you were able to intervene.
Well, I was seeing some very behavior I didn't think it was normal, and I called 5 different therapists before I found somebody willing to see a 4-year-old. Most of them said, no, she'll outgrow it, da-da-da, kids that young don't need any kind of therapy. I said, well, I need to know what's going on. I'm glad I found the therapist I did find, and from her we went to another therapist, and I think that we've come out of it in better shape than we would have if we hadn't found somebody who understood.
Well, I hope your daughter's doing okay.
She's doing considerably better. We've seen so much progress. But because of my experience with her, I do look at other kids and I can go, wow, I wonder.
Yes.
You know, is there something else going on in that other child's life? And, you know, I don't know what I need to do. Do I need to go talk to a parent or...
Right.
Grady?
Well, it's tough. You have to find support groups or what have you. But that, a lot of that, especially in very young children, is either underdiagnosed or misdiagnosed. Like, they don't see it because some people look at it as normal, as normalized behavior. And pediatricians will miss that kind of stuff. And so I'm glad that the caller found someone who understood. And by the way, I would say, when I see kids, I basically cut off about 5, but I will see children at 4. It's not just a child that you see. It's the whole family. It's the mother. So I don't see dealing with that unless you're able to deal with the family also, because you can't treat a 4-year-old in a vacuum. That's just ridiculous. You can't do that. So I'm glad that she found the resources. And you're right. You have to search around for it because, folks, you have to find someone that really understands what that agitated behavior means and where it came from. So I'm glad she found what she needed.
Good. I'm glad you joined us.
When I first started in this field, I worked with juveniles and juveniles at the Alcoholism Center on Greenmount, and we did one of the first grants that was submitted to SAMHSA. We got a grant to deal with children who had alcohol and/or drug problems. Mm-hmm. And when we put the grant together, what we put in the grant was that not only would we treat the kid, but we had to include the parents in the process. And just about every time we came across a kid and we brought the parents in, I could sit right there and look at the problem. Not the kid. The kid was acting out, you see, and the kid broke the law. You know, he had an alcoholic father and mother, and they fought, and the kid ran away from home, and he came under juvenile services as a child in need of supervision. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then I looked at the parents, and I'm saying, yeah, he sure does need supervision. But the problem wasn't the kid. The kid is like an addiction. You know, the drug use is a symptom of the problem. The underlying problem is much bigger than what you see the kid doing. And if you don't look at the home and the structure where this kid is coming from, the apples don't fall too far from the tree.
That's right. If you don't nip that in the bud, then you have a child, a teenager, who's developing what we call a co-occurring mm-hmm. disorder. Mm-hmm. And so he would be perpetrating what his parents have perpetrated.
That was interesting. That's back and forth there. 410-319-8888. Katie in Woodlawn, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Katie.
My question is essentially, I guess, about treatment models. And the way that we're talking about these kids right now, it seems like we are sort of distinguishing from two different groups. You know, some who are little kids that are coming from families that, you know, were feeling cared for and comforted and their needs were met, and then they experience particular trauma, you know, you treat that one way. What about the, you know, these other kids that you're also talking about who are coming from a place where their worlds have never been anything but really pretty traumatic. And so this is, you know, understanding how you might have to adapt treatment to those two different kids. The basic idea behind trauma theory is that the world you know, is essentially benign and safe and trust is appropriate, and traumatized people have an unrealistic view of the world, right? This is what we base on. Of course, for these kids, the world is not essentially benign and safe.
It's not unrealistic, exactly.
And so what happens when we base our treatment models on this kind of, you know, essentially flawed theory? What does it work? You know, what does it work like? How does it look if we're trying to get them back to a baseline of normalcy? Mm-hmm. You know,
really,
doesn't exist.
No, that's a really great question, and we only have a few minutes left. Let me you both want to take a crack at that in a short period, lady.
That is a very good question. In fact, just quickly, I think Mark will remember. I can't remember. Maybe it was about 10 or 12 years ago. I'm not sure. There was a whole expose in the paper about a girl who was consistently victimized sexually by an older male that she lived with. And she didn't know anything else. She eventually died, I think, or something happened to the girl. But to answer the question, the baseline for a child like that is victimization. So I think the call is right. You can't just go from a point where the child is kind of a normalized child and then he becomes victimized. These children, get victimized. What you have to do is, it's really excruciating, but you almost have to train, not retrain. You almost have to train a child relative to what normalization is, because they don't know what normalization is. And that means they have to be exposed to models and role models and situations that look and sound normal. And that takes time and that takes effort. If a child is all he's known from age is violence, for example, or been pushed around by violence, that's all he knows. And when he gets into the school, he acts out those abnormalities. So, yes, that is true. We have to start from a different kind of baseline with those children, and that takes time.
Yeah, it's almost the same thing that I have to do with clients going into a recovery thing. The latest research and work that's being done on the brain with neuroplasticity and the fact that the brain can actually rewire itself based on the environment being changed, create a new memory over top of that old one, is exactly what the doctor's talking about. Mm-hmm. You have to create a new database. Everybody's running off this database called memory. Kids, grown-ups, and everybody, but most people aren't aware of it. They're living the here and now based on historical events, and they bring those things into the here and now. You have to create a new memory or database, and that can only be done consistently over an extended period of time, so the kid will have a different reference point and a newer reference point other than the one that they're actually living out of. I mean, it sounds simplistic, but that's basically the baseline that you have to start working from.
It sounds like the two of you should be training the rest of the city workers on how to get this done. I'm not joking.
We try.
You both do a great deal of work. I want to thank you, all of you, for calling in and being part of the show today. And I want to thank, I'm sorry if we couldn't get to all the calls. We tried to get to as many as we could. I want to thank Dr. Grady Dale, clinical psychologist and executive director of Urban Psychological Services, and Woody Curry, clinical director and associate executive director of the Baltimore Station, for joining us here today. And as we take a look at post-traumatic stress in our children and what to do about it, and we have these continuing conversations on the air because it's our community and we have to put our hands around this. And maybe we'll have a dialogue soon between these gentlemen and some of the folks who do this for the city and see what we can do to make this work right in our own communities. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you very much. Mom. Thank you.
On our way to break here, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com, or you can go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. We'll be right back with a discussion about the man who has been accused of assaulting who had the International Monetary Fund in New York assaulting a woman, an African woman, in her hotel, and how the IMF also assaults women and communities around the world, even without him. More on that when we come back.